last one, we're happy to say, being set up has been the Pilbara Land Council. In 1980, or 1979 at Nookanbar, in the northwest of Australia in the Kimberleys, when the traditional owners tried to stop a drilling company from coming in and drilling for oil on one of their sacred sites, a concept of a national federation was first thought of, or first talked about, and it was finally set up in 1981. In 1980, the Pitjantjatjara Land Rights Bill went through South Australian Parliament, and it was quite different to the Northern Territory Bill, mainly because the traditional owners there were still very much on their own land, and they were able to force the South Australian government into a negotiation and not a land claim situation. And when the bill went through, one-tenth of South Australia, all in the far northwest, which is mainly desert lands, were handed over to those people. And it's, as I said, it's quite different from Northern Territory. In Northern Territory, if you want to claim land, then the traditional owners must go to court and show their association with land. And for most of the traditional owners to do this, it's a very traumatic situation because they have to release information that is very sacred and very secret to them. Under our culture, they're not supposed to disclose that information, but to be able to get their land back, they have to go through this situation of going against the culture to be able to get their lands. The Pitjantjatjara people saw that and said they didn't want to have to go through the same situation. So they went into a negotiation situation. The other problem we have with land in both of those states is that while we have mineral rights, the governments can, in the national interest, take the land back. And what we find is that uranium mining, American military bases, and British military bases are all supposedly in the national interest, and the government can step in and take that land back any time it wants to. The next step in the legal side of the land rights movement was in New South Wales 2 years ago, when the New South Wales Land Right Act was passed through New South Wales government. In New South Wales, again, is a completely different situation to the Northern Territory and South Australia, mainly because in the former two states, the land that was available for claim was unalienated Crown land. And in New South Wales, because it's a much richer country and there is far much less desert in that state, there was very little land that Aboriginal people could claim. One of the things that the New South Wales government has done is put aside a percentage of a land tax for 15 years. And this money is to run the Land Council to be able to, so it can operate underneath the Act. And then what's left over from that can be put aside to buy land, which will eventually be turned into Aboriginal title. The Victorian government, which is presently a Labor government, a so-called left wing government, also came up with a proposed land rights bill, and it was to go before Parliament early last year. The Victorian Aboriginal people were quite upset with that bill and were able to stop it going before Parliament and force the Victorian government into doing a much more community-involved land rights bill. And presently they're going through a process of sitting back at the community level, going around the community and talking about this bill. The next state to do anything was again the Western Australian government, who set up the Seaman Inquiry. There's probably a whole lot of that, but the sister here will be able to talk about that later on. The South Australian government, which was also at the last elections turned to a Labor government, are now talking about the Maralinga case. Anybody who knows about atomic tests will know that there were 7 atomic tests at a place called Maralinga in South Australia. And because of the pressure that Aboriginal people have been able to place on the governments in Australia in the last 7 years about these atomic tests, which happened way back in the 50s, the South Australian government is now talking about getting together a Maralinga land rights case, or land rights bill, which they hope to pass through state parliament. The present form of the Maralinga land rights bill is about half as good as the Pitjantjatjara land rights bill in the same state. But even with those two bills, there is only about one third of a state that will be covered, and the other two thirds and the other language groups in South Australia are still going to end up with nothing. And the South Australian government made a statement last week that once the Maralinga land rights bill is through state parliament, then that's the finish for that state. About 12 months ago, the federal government started to talk about a national land rights bill and entered into talks with the National Federation of Land Councils and the National Aboriginal Conference. And the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs wanted to have a bill ready to put before Parliament in August of this year. When we first started the talks back in July of last year, we told him that we demanded that the federal government finance the not only the land councils but also the NAC to start to talk and consult back at the community level so that the communities can have some input to this proposed national land rights bill. The minister told us that we could do that if we could pay for it, but they weren't going to put any money up for it, and that we had until the 20th of February of this year to do the consultation work. Anybody who knows the region of Australia will see that without money or without facilities, it's next to impossible to get to all of the Aboriginal communities in Australia, because of the distance between communities, the terrain of the country, and the non-availability of public transport throughout most of the country. In the February meeting, the Federation were able to get the other delegates at that meeting to disagree with the minister's timetable. And the last thing that we laid on the table to the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs was that we don't want his schedule anymore. We don't want to be rushed into this thing. But there must be proper community consultation. And as yet, and I left Australia last Sunday, we still haven't had an answer back from the minister on this. He still hasn't decided to answer us on it. There are a number of important things about the National Land Rights Bill. When we first opened up negotiations with the government, we were told point blank that there was no way that the Australian government was going to look at sovereignty. They would not entertain sovereignty at any cost. We decided to continue with the talks, mainly because the majority of Aboriginal people in Australia have no land at all. We're either sitting on reserves owned by the state government, put aside for our management and run by state government managers, or squatting in other places where we can be kicked off at any time. And the reason that we decided to continue with the land rights bill was to get some land back for Aboriginal people who have no land at all. And land is the basis of communities. The other particular piece of legislation which should be before Australian Parliament at the present time is the protection of sacred sites and sacred objects. One of the main problems we've had in the last 30 years is the multinational mining corporations moving into our traditional lands and desecrating our sacred places. And anybody who listens to the news will see or have heard of many of the protest movements, many of the great struggles that we've had in the last 5 years that have hit the international media services. We hope that this legislation will get through Parliament and test out how the feelings are towards the National Land Rights Bill. But one of the things that both the Federation and the NAC are strongly supporting is that this land rights bill doesn't close the gate to sovereignty. And we should, talk about sovereignty a bit. We, as a people, are born with sovereign rights in our own country. It is quite silly or amusing even for European descendants who were born in Australia to claim sovereignty in our country. The only sovereign rights that white Australians have are over Europe. It has nothing to do with our country. We are the only sovereign people. We're born with that right. The only problem is that we're 1% 1% of the population. And we have to force white Australia into realising that situation. We're becoming more and more successful with that nearly every month, with international work and also national work within our own country. It's not that we want to kick these 15 million illegal immigrants out of our country, and in reality it's exactly what they are. But the way we look at it is that if we went and rented a house from somebody else, then we would have to pay that rent. And these people are living in our house because Australia is our house. If they want to live there, then they must pay the rent. But also, if you live in somebody else's house, not only you pay the rent, but you also have to abide by the rules that they have in that house. We as a people have many laws for our own country. And if people want to live in our house, then they must abide by our laws and respect those laws. Otherwise, they must be evicted. And people must come to realise that, not only within Australia, but also on a worldwide basis. If we look to the east of Australia, we see many countries in the Pacific who are now governed and run by the indigenous people from those countries. You can see Vanuatu, the Solomons, Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Western Samoa, Kiribati, Tonga. If we look to the west, we see that the majority of Africa is also run by the indigenous people of that country and doing quite a good job of governing themselves, of governing the lives of their people. And we are quite sick and tired of living under another system which is alienable to us, which has no respect for our people, no respect for our laws, and much less respect for our country. Australia today is probably one of the most desecrated countries in the world. In the last 200 years, one-third of our country has turned into desert, which was rich forest land 200 years ago. And what we're saying is that if people want to live in our house, then they must respect it. You know, if I was living in your house and I started to dig your land, you know, get an axe and cut your lounge chair up and started to dig up the floorboards because I thought I could make some money out of it, you'd be quite unhappy with that, you know. You'd get a bit wild about it. We realize that. But when people start digging up our country, our home, then we get wild about that too. We look towards the future of our children. And how can there be a future for our children when our country has been turned into a desert where nobody can live? And I kind of sometimes get a bit upset with white people. I kind of try to think how they hate their children so much. Because what seems to motivate particularly the corporations, but also most Europeans, is money for the present. How much riches, how much stuff they can get together. But they don't look towards the future of their children and how their children are going to live. And I think if we're going to be a responsible people and if we're going to have responsible tenants in our house, then together we have to look towards the future and how our children are going to survive in our own country. And therefore we demand that the illegal immigrants in our country pay the rent but also respect the rules of our house. In the last, yesterday and this morning, I've heard much talk about equal rights. And I can assure you that our movement has, we don't want equal rights with whites. That's the most boring life anybody could be forced to live. I've been forced to live beside the European society all my life. And I've never seen anything as boring as European society. People who are forced to go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, finish up at 5 o'clock, you've probably got to travel a couple of hours to get to work. And it's all to make somebody else rich who can have a good life. And man, I don't want that for my kids. We don't want that for ourselves. It's a boring life. We're not talking about equal rights. We're talking about the rights of indigenous people in their own country. We are the sovereign people, we are the owners. So we want the sovereign rights of our nation. I've also heard the talk of protection of cultural heritage and that people must legislate to protect our cultural heritage. How is that possible? How can a European government pass laws to protect our heritage? That's nearly as silly as a concept of equal rights. Nobody can protect our cultural heritage but ourselves. And we must be allowed in our own country, in our own lands, to be able to follow our cultural heritage and do with it what we please, not what some government tells us what we must do. I think I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. O'Neill. Could I just ask you a couple of questions before we pass on to Alf Isaac Kiskatalo? In the Northern Territory, you say that since the mid-70s, land has been turned back to the Aboriginal people. Can you tell us how it is held? Is it held in trust by the federal government, or do the land councils hold it in fee simple, or?
I'll let Stan answer that because he's the chairman of land councils who deal in that type of work all the time.
The land that was given back to Aboriginal people in Northern Territory, there might be 6 or 7 groups of people who own that land. Out of that 6 or 7 groups, the tribe themselves picks out 6 or 7 elderly people, and they form a land trust. And they're the one who holds it for their people and the children in the future. They're not the bosses. And don't tell the people what to do. They just hold it for future generation. And they're not allowed to sell it.
Thank you. Do you know if the system in... Mr. O'Neill said that in South Australia, under an earlier... under earlier legislation, the northwest corner was given back to the people. How is that, by what arrangement is that held, Mr. O'Neill?
It was actually later than the Northern Territory Bill. The Northern Territory Bill went in 76. The Pitjantjatjara Land Council Bill went, the Pitjantjatjara Bill went through in 1980. It's a bit different from the Northern Territory situation. Every Pitjantjatjara person or every traditional owner who are Pitjantjatjara people, even as children are born, they immediately when they're born, they're sovereign people of that land. And they decided that they should set up an incorporated body separate from the land council so it wouldn't interfere with the land council's political stands. And every traditional owner is a member of that organisation. And that organization holds the land title.
Yes, David Case.
Mr. Scruton, what's the relationship in the Northern Territories between the land trusts that you described and the land council? There are those two institutions, is that correct? The land trust and the Land Council?
Well, the Land Council keeps the names of the people who are on the Land Trust. And the Land Council doesn't tell the traditional owners what to do, or the Land Council doesn't pick out the people that they want to put on as Land Trustees. The people themselves, the traditional owners, put them.
Just,
Shorty O'Neill? In Australia, after 1967, in all states except Queensland and Tasmania, the government set up land trusts. And I think that was the point of your question. Of course, Queensland has never gotten rid of Aboriginal affairs, although the other states handed it over to the federal government. And Tasmania still won't admit it has any Aboriginal people, although it accepts $2 million every year for their welfare. But then we'll tell you they don't have any. But in Western Australia, South Australia, Victoria, and New South Wales, Aboriginal people were appointed by the government to set up a land trust and work very closely with the government. And they held in lease the former reserves. And any Aboriginal person who lived on those reserves had to get permission from the land trust to do with whatever they could. And there was a lot of bad feelings there. The land trust in the Northern Territory is quite separate from that. It's a whole different deal. And very much works with the land council. So it's Aboriginal people working with Aboriginal people rather than Aboriginal people being forced to work for white Australian governments.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Scruton. Chuck Smythe, did you have a question?
I have a question for Mr. Scruton. Under the Northern Territory Land Rights Bill, the procedure, if industry is interested in some land in the subsurface estates set up by that bill, was for them to approach the government and then the government to approach the land councils, I believe. Has industry ever expressed an interest in the land, in any parts of land, and what was the outcome of that process?
Well, industry expresses an interest in it about every second minute. there are a number of controversial situations in the Northern Territory where the mining, particularly the mining industry, has had things to do. One, I suppose, would be known internationally was the Ranger uranium mine, where the Northern Land Council ended up signing an agreement so that this mine could go ahead. It's something we really don't want to get into here, because while the Northern Land Council is a land council, it's not a member of the Federation. So we don't want to sort of get into an argument overseas with home policies, eh? But the companies come to the Land Council, and there are negotiations between the company and the Land Councils. And there have been a number of successfully negotiated settlements where mining can happen, where the traditional owners in that region are quite happy with the agreement that's been made with the company, and where the company acts as a responsible person towards the Aboriginal people, who acts responsibly and recognises the right of the traditional owners in that region. But there are many other companies, many places, not only in the Northern Territory, but also in South Australia, and particularly the Pitjantjatjara people, where companies try and bulldoze over the top of the people and don't act in a responsible manner at all. In those cases, we've been able to stop those mining companies from coming in. And we're in a position, in fact, in some of the places in Northern Territory and South Australia, where we can start to make the mining companies act like responsible people and respect other people's ownership of things. But many other parts, like Comalco, one of the companies that has had a very good agreement with the Pitjantjatjara people in South Australia, is completely bulldozing over the top of people in North Queensland. It's and in the Kimberley region, because they're also tied up with the diamond industry there. But what we're finding is that where that law is in place, then these guys have got to sit down and talk to us, and they've got to act in a responsible manner. In places where we don't have that, they just move in and rip off. And I think that we've probably overcome most of the problems in those regions. In fact, I think it was 2 years ago, one of the mining companies which wanted to mine on pit land and had a fairly good case that it would have had to take before a high Australian court because of the land rights bill, and the Finnish didn't even bother going to court because they knew they had no chance of winning it. They came in with their standover tactics and tried to stand over people. And the pit mob refused to negotiate with them. And then they tried to take them to court, and it was dropped at the low court level because they had no chance of taking it any higher. So in those instances, we're now bringing the mining companies to act as responsible people. And anybody who can make a mining company act responsible, I think, is worth shaking his hand.
Doug Sanders, and then Mark Gordon. Goes on the record.
One of the things that struck me as complex about the Northern Territory land claim settlement was the fact that two land councils were created for a large area and a considerable number of linguistic groups. I understand that since that time, the model of the two has ended, and that there are more than two land councils now in the Northern Territory. I wonder if you could comment on how many there are, and whether you think that actually it should have been structured on a more local basis than originally, or that it may wind up being on a more local basis than it is now.
There's, in fact, there was only one split with only one other new land council created, and that was in the northern region, in the northern land councils region. It's an area of islands are called the Tiwi people, who are culturally a lot different from the mainland people. And they decided, because they were much more of a cultural group, that they would break away and form their own land council. I think it was around the time of the Ranger Agreement. The Central Land Council, and we totally agree that there are big problems with the structure of the land councils in the Northern Territory, how the government has set them up, because they are very much open to rip-offs, to not being properly represented. But the Central Land Council is much different, very different from the North and the Tiwi, where the language groups are very much able to get on together, and that the delegates come from each different language group, each different community within those language groups. There is moves to set up area councils which will come under the Central Land Council. We don't know a hell of a lot about the Northern Land Council, as again I said, it doesn't come into the National Federation, and we haven't had much to do with it. Stan, do you want to?
Mark Gordon, you had a question.
I'd like to know on when you get your land claim settlements in Australia, whether you're given compensation for past damages. Like the Alaska Native Claim Settlement, I believe there was a large amount of cash for this. In the James Bay Agreement, we had a compensation for past damages. I'm wondering if you have the same type of thing in your claims.
The Australian government at no time has ever talked about compensation. It's not only compensation for past damages to land. It's also the compensation to people. Most of the rich Australians have made their money not only off our land, but also off using our people as slaves. You know, their money comes from our sweat and blood and our country. There is not one pastoral property in Australia which could have survived without the use of Aboriginal slave labour in the past 200 years. But besides all of that, when the Europeans first came to our country, the first invasion in 1788, we estimate that there were over 3 million Aboriginal people in our whole country. I know that a few white academics will disagree with that, but they can't agree over the number, and I've never seen white academics agree over anything at any given time. But we estimate that it was over 3 million. In 1925, there were 27,000 Aboriginal people left in Australia. So we don't only want compensation for the problems to our land, we want it for the atrocities, the massacres, the destruction to the Aboriginal society and our people.
Peter Atinwar, you had a question.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure how to put this. It may be sensitive. You mentioned sovereignty. You mentioned rent by Europeans in your house. I wonder if you could not, because the notion of sovereignty has met with a great deal of opposition in the Western world, I wonder if you, couldn't you temper your notion of sovereignty with political aspirations that are, if not more realistic, at least more attainable?
I don't believe that we have to push anything down. You know, we are a sovereign people, that's it. There is no going back on that, and you can only be born sovereign people. You know, you can't gain, if I walk into a bank here in Alaska with a gun and start to take the money out, I'll be in jail tomorrow. And yet that's exactly what's happened to our country. The Europeans came with a gun and stole it, you know. And they cannot steal sovereignty. Nobody can steal sovereignty, you're born with it. It's a birthright. And the only sovereignty they have is over Europe, you know. Not even here in America is there European sovereignty. It's in Europe. It can't be given, it can't be taken by treaty or anything else. You're born with sovereignty over the lands where your ancestors come from. And we can't back down from that movement. There's no way we can do that and still be a responsible people. And if people, you know, if they want to live, as I said before, if they want to live with us, then they have to act also responsibly towards the owners of that place. You know, if you go to the... We're stopping in the Westwood Hilton. If I start going and kicking up a big mess in there, I'm going to get kicked out. And, you know, I come here to Alaska. There's certain laws in this country. We're here as visitors. We respect those laws. If anybody comes to our country, then they must sit down and respect our laws also. That's common courtesy. That's acting as a responsible human being. You know, this concept of being able to go to somebody else's country and take it over belongs in the 15th century. I thought Europe had grown up beyond that. This is, you know, four centuries later, and they're still talking about we can go to somebody else's country and take it over. You know, that's not really an adult attitude towards a responsible future for other people. I think Europe has to grow up out of the 15th century.
Well, you were right, Peter. It's a sensitive question. Steve Cackfrey wanted to say something. Did you?
Yes. I think the the question I have is pretty long what Peter is asking. It comes out of the First Minister's conference that occurred last week in Ottawa, in Canada, with ourselves as the Aboriginal people of Canada meeting with the provinces and the federal government. My understanding walking away from that conference was the federal government offered to the Aboriginal people self-government or self-governing institutions basically suggesting, yes, we agree you should have some authority, some responsibility, and we were willing to give it to you. So you have perhaps a compromise where they do not say, yes, we recognize you have sovereignty, that yes, you have the right to govern yourself as a nation, but what we're willing to do is give you a measure of authority that we have and let you exercise it as you wish upon yourselves rather than let us exercise it on you. And it seems to me what you're saying, Shorty, was that the parliamentary legislation does not, the land rights bill you're talking about in Australia, in your mind, does not extinguish that particular right. That, as far as you're concerned, it can never be extinguished. And that perhaps the government might, the Australian government might want to continue saying, as far as they're concerned, you don't have rights, and for yourselves to say, well, you do, and it doesn't matter what type of legislative arrangements you make between yourselves. I don't have any particular notion about it, but my tendency right now is to believe that if you agree to anything less than that right, you agree to a delegation or someone to say, well, no, we don't think you have that right, but we're willing to let you exercise some responsibility, some control. It's a question for the collective, I think. It's a question for all the people to address.
Could we
Could we treat that as an observation by Steve Kakwe, and perhaps just to hear one more observation or question from Dennis Patterson, and then move on to our next speaker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to be brief. I was intrigued by Mr. O'Neill's suggestion that governments have no place protecting cultural values, which and language, Aboriginal languages would be included in that, I would think.
European governments, he said.
European governments
have no place protecting Aboriginal culture and language. I think that was the point.
I understand that point. And I agree that governments cannot do what parents must do to pass on language and traditions and religion and culture, other cultural values. But I'd like to know, first of all, what success have indigenous peoples in Australia had in preserving their languages and their, well, particularly their languages? Are the indigenous languages, the hundreds of indigenous languages, in good health? And would you not consider that legislation protecting or recognizing indigenous languages as official languages and providing as a constitutional right funds to provide bilingual education might not aid in that process if parents can't do the job themselves despite their best efforts?
I'm glad you said the word recognizing. You cannot protect something. Legislation cannot protect it. It can recognize it, but it cannot protect it. And I think that's what we're on about. The language question in Australia, probably nearly one half of the languages are still fluently spoken today. And in Aboriginal run and controlled schools, and there are more and more of those coming up every day, starting up, the local language is the first language. And in some cases, English is a seventh or eighth language. Because we believe that we have a right to learn our own languages first before we're forced to live this language with this society that we're forced to live beside. On the East Coast, and particularly in the South, the languages aren't healthy, and in fact some were nearly wiped out up until about 10 years ago. And because of a referendum, because of a court case that I referred to before, things have become a little easier in Australia. Before 1967, every state in Australia, including Tasmania, who supposedly doesn't have Aboriginals, had a protection law for Aboriginal people. The South African apartheid laws were based, modelled on the Queensland Aboriginal Act, probably one of the worst of these protection laws. But before 67, we couldn't travel without having permits. We couldn't get married unless we had the permission of a manager who ran the reserve that we lived on. You know, there were curfew bells and quite a heck of a lot of things around, and it was, if children spoke languages, then they were belted by the whites, actually flogged by the whites who were running the reserves. And on the East Coast, and down in the south of Australia, around Adelaide, and a little bit over in Western Australia also, and in Tasmania, some of these languages were nearly lost. But in the last 10 years, since the floggings and the protection laws that were gotten rid of from most states except Queensland, Queensland still holds an Aboriginal protection law till right now, it has become much easier to pass the language on.
Well, I wonder if I could, as chairman, exercise what feeble authority I have and move the discussion on. We'll return to Australia and we'll hear from Shorty O'Neill and Stanley Scrutton, and of course we look forward to hearing from Maureen Kelly later on. But I think it might be useful if we moved to another country now and asked Alf Isaac Cascatello from Norway to tell us about the history and current condition and claims of the Sami people of Scandinavia.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I have to thank you for the opportunity to come here and speak on the Sami situation. Secondly, I have to take some deep breaths after the engaging speak of Shorty O'Neill. He touched upon the question of bringing up the European people, European colonialists. And that is why I sigh, because all the time the Sami people has been living in contact with internal European colonialism. It has, in a sense, always been exactly this perspective we have had to have on the question, to try to convene or show to the European nations how important it is for us to be able to go on living as a people, as an indigenous group in Europe. Since 1975, when the Sami organizations got involved in the cooperation within the World Council of Indigenous Peoples, we have been seeing how similar the questions relating to land rights questions, to cultural rights,